very happy at a small college in the Midwest, but my wife was not happy. And she was a girl from Larchmont, and she desperately wanted to get east. And so I had written an article in America that had gotten some attention, and I sent out letters to all kinds of places, including Marist College. And at first I had no response from Marist College, although my wife was particularly interested because she liked the idea of Poughkeepsie. She had been through Poughkeepsie, and it was, she knew, much more convenient than someplace in New Jersey. And so so she talked to a friend of hers in Poughkeepsie, who spoke to her husband, who spoke to his office mate, Jack Gartland. And then I heard from Marist College. And a brother had just informed them that he was leaving. They didn't tell me that, but that's what I found out. And so they were going to need somebody, and they were going to need somebody in, with my credentials. So I talked to people at the convention in New York, but I hadn't heard from Marist until afterwards, so I arranged to come up and see Linus Foy. And the day of that I was supposed to come, we had an ice storm. And my in-laws suddenly became terribly afraid that we'd go on our walk and die on the way and leave the children on them. So I called Foy, and we talked over the telephone. And then we went back, and I liked the idea of Marist as a new college. And I've been teaching with brothers, not Marist brothers, but Christian brothers, and I enjoyed that. So the idea of a new place appealed to me. Then we got offers from two other colleges, one in New Jersey and one in outside Philadelphia. And we hadn't heard from Marist. I guess I could tell you indeed about the third offer I got. I had gone around at the convention, and I knocked on the door and banged on the door, and finally it opened, and a man sort of hung his head out from the jamb. Told me to come in and pour myself a drink. So I went in, and here's this table full of bottles and glasses and ice and stuff. So I poured myself a drink. And pretty soon a man came out, and he saw me sitting there with the drink, and I think he immediately thought he had a soulmate. And I handed him my drink. Oh yeah, this is just fine. You're the right one.
That's good. It seems there was a lot of obstacles blocking your way, Max. I'm glad you found it.
Well, you know, as I sat there, and I thought, this guy wants a drinking partner, and the last thing I want to do is, you know, sit around and drink with him for the next 30 years. But anyhow, well, we called Marist, and I said, you know, I had these two offers, and I had to answer them. Well, at least you have an offer in the mail from Marist. So I waited, and it was the best offer. And so we came here.
That's great. That's a great story. It seemed like there was so many obstacles. And finally, all got
straight. Yeah, we all arrived. Yeah.
Did the location of the college like influence your decision to come here?
It did. It did, because my wife's family were in Larchmont, and Larchmont is less than 2 hours from here by car, and it's 2 hours not through heavy traffic. And if I'd gone to St. Peter's in Jersey City, we would have had to buck all of the New York and Westchester traffic. And she couldn't see where would you live in New Jersey. She didn't know at that point. And if we'd gone to Philadelphia, it would have been still farther. So the location did.
And you probably would feel more comfortable as a history professor teaching in a historically rich area like the Hudson Valley.
Yeah, well, I didn't know how rich the Hudson Valley was.
Which we'll get to.
Yeah.
Yep. Did you know that they're offering a course now, next semester?
I'm glad to hear it. Who's offering it?
I'm not sure, but I noticed that you weren't.
No, I'm not. It might be Billy Berg. And if so, she'll do a good job.
How do you feel about that? I mean, it is a rich area of history.
Oh, it is. It is. Yeah, and I think we should do it. And I think I think Billy Berg, who is just an adjunct with us now, but who really pioneered a history program here some years ago. And it it's just possible that one of her students may replace me at Marist. He's one of the candidates that we're looking at, you know, and having a little connection here, you know, gives him some start. But we haven't been through any interviews yet, so I don't know whether that would happen or not. But Billy went through Marist, and she got into this thing, and then she did a good job, too.
It's really worthwhile for the students to know about the culture of their area, too, about the history of their area.
I think the history of this area is very interesting and very rich. And I'm very glad that Tom Casey has done as much with it as he has done, and Bill.
Have you done anything yourself?
Well, what have I done? When I first came here, I said, we have to do two things. We have to connect with the Roosevelt Library, and we got somebody to do that. And we have to connect with the local community. And because this place was behind a wall, and it was mostly student brothers, and, mm-hmm. and you know, they knew we existed, but that was about all.
Isolated from the community.
So, yeah, so I joined the first thing, the most obvious thing, was the Historical Society. Mm-hmm. And I was welcomed with open arms.
Sure.
And one of the people who welcomed me was the retired president of Vassar, Henry Noble McCracken. And, but at any rate, the first thing I knew, I was on their board of trustees. And that was a great experience because you're sitting there with all these people who have nothing to do but sort of meditate about history.
It's a very relaxing environment.
Oh, yeah. Very relaxing environment. You could go to sleep easily, you know. But every so often we would get a letter to the effect that they wanted us to write a letter to the Department of Transportation to save a house. And there'd be a little conversation about it, and someone'd say, well, that house, there's much left in that house. And, well, that was never an important house, but we'd write the letter. And I realized two things. I realized, first, we had no criteria. We didn't know what we were doing. And second, it didn't matter because we weren't going to do anything about it anyhow. The Department of Transportation or somebody would get the letter and they'd say, here's the letter from Dutchess County Historical Society. They'd say, well, file it under Dutchess County Historical Society.
The round file.
And so, you know, it disappeared. So I approached the college and the president of the Historical Society and said, why don't we hold a conference at Marist on historical preservation in the Hudson Valley? Find out something about it. And so that was okay, and I wound up as the person in charge. And we had just been through at Marist a Catholic-Jewish conference organized by the Libreth. And they had really taught me how you run a conference. And so I put using that as a model. We sent letters out to everybody that I could think of who would either have an interest in preservation, historic preservation, or in county in planning for the area, because it was full of talk about planning at the time. And we wound up holding the conference at Marist, and I had run across quite a few very capable people, architects and planners and the people just, I think the man who had done the film that had persuaded the government to make Bryce Canyon, Utah, a national park. And he was now in this area and interested in those things.
Did your influence in the Preservation Society help retain historical status to the two buildings on Marist?
Yeah, they come. They're kind of at the end of it. When we started out, those two buildings were considered nothing, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And everything was in the new modern buildings. Right. Mm-hmm. Now we've trashed the new modern buildings and replaced them with other buildings. But now we like the three historic buildings.
Three,
really.
Right.
And so, sure, yeah. But the, you know, those things go around.
On the second question, the focus of our project is the social history of Marist. Mm-hmm. What social changes have you noticed that have happened at Marist that you believe have had like the most significant impact?
I think the most significant impact is the coming of lay students. And when I first came here, the lay students were already here, but the majority were still the Christian, the brothers. And the brothers were a very nice community. They were very bright. They were tremendous students. They had great morale. They were building the place. And they, you know, we were really teaching very top flight group of students. Mm-hmm. And there was also an extraordinary sense of community. I mean, we still keep the word community and we still keep the idea at Marist. Mm-hmm. But when we first came here, you know, everybody knew everybody. Everything happened in Donnelly Hall. There was this very close kind of community. Indeed, when the middle stage came, they said, this is impossible. They said, well, lovely, but it can't last. They were right, of course. but that was the first major change, I would say.
With the co-education?
Co-ed would be the second major change. Yeah, that's right. I'm not, you know, I think it's been delightful having the girls here. But I'm not sure that it's made as big a change as the change from that early community that Marist was.
Right.
It's been a significant change and a good change and all those things. But,
sure.
I think we are probably coming into some changes now with the changing geographic location of the freshmen, mm-hmm. more foreign students and that kind of thing.
Do you think that benefits Marist, that we're getting geographically wider?
Yeah, I think it's a good thing for Marist. I think we always felt Marist was in danger of being too much one thing, one mm-hmm. kind of place. I would say, however, that as important probably as the coming of lay students or the coming of women students was the impact of the 60s, and then almost equally important, the disappearance of the 60s.
How did the students react to the Vietnam War?
They were concerned. But at Marist, we held a teach-in that was widely regarded as very unusual in the sense that it included, it took all day long, and we had speakers on both sides of the Vietnamese War question. So we had Dan Berrigan was here, and a young fellow named Stoughton Lind, who was the new left leader, intellectual leader in the country. And we had the local congressman, Joseph Y. Resnick, who defended the war. And we had a brother of Henry Cabot Lodge, a former governor of Connecticut and ambassador to Spain or someplace, was here. A Chinese general, and you know.
Pretty stellar panel.
It was a lot of people, and they took the main entry of the campus center. Mm-hmm. So they put these guys up just in front of the stairs, and then people went down one wing and back the other wing, and we had television set up in various other rooms so people could watch it went on all day. And I think in a sense this summarized it. The students came generally, I mean, we had a 3-hour student strike when Nixon went into Cambodia. But the thing about Marist was I don't think we ever lost courtesy, friendship. There was a great deal of argument and discussion, but it was always a friendly argument and discussion.
It was positive, yeah.
Yeah, it's a very positive, and Marist was enormously positive all through the 60s.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
It wasn't affected by the resentment feeling like maybe other campuses like
no, Kent no, it really wasn't. It really wasn't. Part of this was Linus Foy. Foy, anybody could see Foy at any time. We had a student who walked into Foy and he demanded, he said, I want to know the Board of Trustees. Foy handed him a sheet of paper. He said, I want to know their business affiliation. Foy handed him another sheet of paper. He said, I want to know the college's investments. Foy handed him a very small sheet of paper. Then he didn't know what to do. He
right.
walked out, he said, I got what they struck it for at Columbia.
Right.
Any idea what you did with this information? But he got it.
Just take it.
But he had it. But we were able to do this. We also, I think we were lucky. We got in history, we hired, I wouldn't say we went looking for a radical teacher, professor, but when we got a chance to hire one, and we took my fellow named Joe Norton. And I remember Foy spent an hour talking with him. And George Score and I took him out to dinner, and we argued the evening away. But we found out that he heard what was said to him, he replied to it directly, he was an honest man. he was an informed man, he just happened to take a very strong view on the war and other questions, although the left agenda. And Joe became a very important thing in the lives of the students, and he was kind of the focal point of Vietnamese war criticism and so on. Mm-hmm. But because Joe was a very responsible guy,
he knew how to.
Yeah, that's right. He kept that in perspective. Yeah. And so Marist would, but I think it was a march in Poughkeepsie, and all the local colleges were going to go. And somebody from one of the other colleges got up, and they wanted some violence on the end of it. Joe got up, and he made a speech and stopped that. We pull out. So they didn't pull out. But Marist made a great name for itself because people did all kinds of positive things about the community at Marist at that time.
That's great. Yeah. Do you think that the students today are more or less aware of the political events?
Less aware.
People were more active back then?
Oh yeah, much, much more. People today are less aware than they were in the 50s. When we had an active Republican and an active Democratic club on the campus, and they were involved in the issues, and they held debates, and they did various kinds of things. I would say that somewhere in the 70s, we got a group of students who just turned off. And people nationwide, vandalism went up. You couldn't get students who would sit on faculty committees. Everything 60 students had won. These students
took away.
Wouldn't touch. They were a problem in the dorms, mm-hmm. beating people up, this kind of thing.
Was Joe still around? Or?
No, Joe left us, alas. Well, Joe stayed for a while and he fought it, and then he decided to leave. He walked out on it.
What do you think brought that about, the change?
I've heard it suggested that these kids were the younger brothers and sisters of the 60 students, and they sat home and listened to their parents complaining. But they felt that they would get into all kinds of trouble if they spoke up in any way, so you never found out what they thought. Their motto was, tell me what to do and I'll do it, and it was a sullen sort of thing.
And you really noticed that on the campus?
Oh yeah, this was just a bad, bad show. Now it gradually faded out. But I remember we had a student body president who was picked up for shoplifting. Of course, that was one thing that ran through the nation for a brief time. Everybody had a shoplift.
So the community started to deteriorate a little bit?
Yeah, it did. And I think it's rebuilt somewhat, right. But it did deteriorate.
Then did you notice another difference of the transitional phase into the 80s?
Yeah, but it was much more gradual. As it moved into the 80s and into the present moment. I think there's probably, we went through in the late 80s a kind of period of party culture where, that was the only thing, and that's, to my mind, that's dull. Now, I mean, parties are all right. If you work together, you play, you've done stuff together, then you get together and you have, you play with your friends. But if parties are the whole thing, then myself.
It was a big party school.
It was for a while. For a while, it was a big party school, and that I think detracted from everything else. But I think maybe we're pulling out of that, but I'm not that sure. But
your role here, do you as a like one of the senior faculty? And what do you perceive your role as being? Like, is your perception of your role here changed from when you first came to
town? Yes, it has. When I first came here, I served on most of the major committees, and I was very active in the politics and this kind of thing. And today I am primarily a teacher. I go to meetings, I offer opinions, mm-hmm. but primarily I've been more and more just a teacher. I do a little bit more scholarship than I did early on. so busy. But the it's maybe not exactly the way one would expect the drawers change, but it's, a lot of people's drawers change that way too. Action is tends to be in 40-year-olds always.
So this is your final year at Marist. What are your plans?
Well, I have two concrete plans. And the first is a book that I've got about four chapters, at least a rough draft done. And it's a book that will deal with the way people come of age in this country at this time. And it will be a book that looks at it from a point of view that I think is a little unusual. That is how time is handled. It seems to us, for example, my grandmother gave up a promising career as a one-room school teacher when she graduated from it. And she went out to the Idaho frontier and took on five small children. And with those children, then four of her own, she raised. They all grew up. They, you know, all married, all had families, all paid their taxes, all stayed out of jail. And but she was, in short, right in the middle of life and challenge at 18. And I think we are preventing people from doing this. And we're pushing it further and further and further back. So that my son and his bride married in the latter half of the 30s and just had their first child. I think that's become a very common pattern.
Right. Waiting.
Yeah, people waiting, and it's more a matter that there's no real place to start taking these responsibilities on until you say, oh my gosh, if I don't do it now, you can't do it.
I think a sense maybe of stability is important to people nowadays. Do you feel that with careers, getting settled in your career?
Yeah, I think the career has become central. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a disaster from the point of view of nation and others, because I think it means we do things like sacrifice this poor question of when do you have a private life to where do you get on in your career. And I think by and large, this doesn't mean that I don't think we do any better in the careers. I think it's just a matter that, you know, this is where it's at. And then maybe the recreation world goes with it. And it takes people away from all kinds of other responsibilities. But I think they don't grow up that way. I think it's a way of retarding maturity. That may seem like a lot of radical notions, but the book will, I think, have some radical notions in it. So I'm doing a lot about the way we conceive of age. For example, we use the word teenager. Well, that means that we take the word 10, that mathematical concept, and we impose it on people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think that the person of 18 and the person of 13 are not the same kind.
Right.
You know, I think there's tremendous difference there. And I think we push the 13-year-old ahead too fast, and we hold the 18-year-old back.
Mm-hmm. Labels really affect
people. I think they do affect, yeah, I think they do. And I think this one has had a very unfortunate effect.
Could you use Marist and the campus and everything you've been experiencing out here is like a laboratory for like seeing this.
Yeah, you could say this. If we go back to the 50s and the student interest in things like politics, you go through the 60s and their interest in the community, their interest in everything under the sun, how the college is run. They found the football team as a club activity. It was great. Mm-hmm. I mean, no sport we have here now has the kind of impact on the student body that football team had. Mm-hmm. Everybody got together and they made it, they created it, and it was important. But it wasn't the only thing they were doing. We didn't become a football school.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They were founding the Children's Theater, and they were putting out a great circle and a superb annual.
It's very evident that Marist holds academics for athletics.
Well, I hope so.
Yes. Which is, some schools do stray from that now.
Yeah.
It's a problem with that.
I was stunned. Did you see about this kid at Ohio State? He came down to the athletic department, and he had has his registration. The coach takes it, tears it up, and hands him what he said, recreational manager.
And when they graduate, I mean...
Nothing, that's nothing.
Right.
That's nothing. But this kid quit.
Did he?
He quit the team.
Realized, that's good, though.
He quit the team. And they didn't investigate. The university didn't fire the head coach. They didn't fire the coach who was in charge of academics. They didn't fire the athletic director. They didn't fire the president.
It's probably undetected a lot of the time, majority of the time.
Very much undetected. This kid had the guts to stand up and do it. I think he should be a Heisman myself.
Right.
But
just come to Marist.
That's right.
Since you're leaving us now, where would you like to see Marist go in the future? What do you think?
I would like to see Marist set a firm cap on numbers. And move back into it reinforces liberal direction more strongly. I don't think that's what's going to happen, but that's what I would like to see happen. Yeah.
What do you think the cap should be? The ceiling should be for students, the enrollment.
Well,
it should remain as small.
Yeah, I think we should remain small.
Right.
Yeah, I think we should develop the facilities to handle the students we have. Mm-hmm. And that means finding money, but I think that the college, if it chose this direction, there's money that it could get. Mm-hmm. I think that, in a sense, we followed another chain of money, mm-hmm. which I have no objection to us being in computers, or I mean, I do object to the existence of, with all due respect to this thing, to the existence of anywhere in this country, on any campus, of an undergraduate school of communications. My theory is that this is something that should be approached only after somebody has a degree in something substantive. That communications are just too darn important to be turned over to people who have not had an education. And I find an awful lot of the reporting that comes out in the papers indicates this. The reporter is reporting something he doesn't have any idea what this thing's all about. So he looks for a spectacular statement, somebody attacking somebody.
Sensational stories.
Yeah. And you don't get any serious consideration. Mm-hmm. And you get honest reporting, or intelligent reporting.
Sure. Do you think that the Corps covers enough background for the student in communications?
No.
It doesn't?
No.
It doesn't.
I think the Corps is valuable, I think Corps is valuable for everybody. But for communications, I think that's a terribly important field.
Mm-hmm.
It's too important to be treated like business administration.
Two trite questions for you. We'll wrap it up pretty soon.
Yeah.
What is the most positive aspect that you've experienced at Marist?
I would have to say the classroom. But I would have, because that's been there always. Mm-hmm. That's been there always. The early days at Marist Greeting fantastically exciting. The creation of the college.
And the build up.
Yeah, the build up there. And the 60s. The 60s were extraordinary. Because we had all kinds of exciting things going on here with the students and the faculty.
What was the most negative experience in the 70s with the community?
Yeah, I would say so. I found every so often it seems to me that there's been a strong move against the liberal arts, and that is always a negative experience in my view. But then we have to fight for ourselves anyhow. Yeah.
That's fine. Well,
okay.
Do you have any more questions?
No,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Enjoyable. And we'll show you the tape when.